Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
We're all sort of incredulous that this suit is focusing on Southeast Alaska fisheries when there are a lot bigger threats that southern resident killer whales are facing.
NOAA tells Southeast troll fishermen that they might still get a king salmon season this summer. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 8th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, the Mat-Su School Board adopts controversial policies aimed at transgender students despite some opposition.
We do not throw away established principles just because a small group of people call for the denial of other people's rights, when your job is to protect the rights.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska is growing quickly, so construction jobs are in high demand. 1 in 20 jobs in Alaska are in construction, and with the industry expanding every year, Alaska needs a bigger workforce. The University of Alaska system offers accessible construction management programs, giving students the skills they need to empower Alaska. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
The National Marine Fisheries Service hasn't ruled out the possibility of opening the summer troll season for king salmon in Southeast Alaska, despite a federal judge's recent ruling to the contrary. During a meeting held Wednesday in Sitka, NOAA's Regional Fisheries Administrator for Alaska, John Kurland, told a room full of trollers that the agency was working hard to correct the problems identified in a federal lawsuit brought by a conservation group in Washington state. If successful, Southeast trawlers might be able to harvest king salmon this summer, if not on the traditional day of July 1st, then possibly in August. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
To get a feel for the impact of the Wild Fish Conservancy lawsuit on Southeast trawlers, try sitting in a room filled with them. Grizzled oldsters, seasoned men and women hardened by life on the ocean, well-known fisheries advocates, young families, and a baby or two. John Kurland is the Regional Administrator for Fisheries in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which, among other agencies, oversees the National Marine Fisheries Service. That's a lengthy title, but Kurland said that he is a neighbor, and he gets it.
First off, I know that there's been just a huge amount of concern about the implications of this suit and the potential for the troll fishery not to be able to open. I live in Juneau. I have a sense of how important this fishery is for Southeast Alaska, for a lot of small businesses, a lot of families, a lot of communities. It's a big deal.
The Washington state-based Wild Fish Conservancy sued the National Marine Fisheries Service in federal court in 2020, arguing that nymphs had violated the Endangered Species Act by failing to fully account for the impact of Southeast trolling on king salmon, an important prey for a small population of endangered orcas in Puget Sound called southern resident killer whales. The conservancy won, and a judge ordered Southeast Alaska king salmon trolling shut down until the problem could be remedied. And it's just commercial trolling for Chinook in Southeast Alaska. No other commercial or sport fishery anywhere from Alaska to California is affected. It's a baffling strategy, and Kurland is as surprised as anyone that the suit got this far.
We're all sort of incredulous that this suit is focusing on Southeast Alaska fisheries when there are a lot bigger threats that southern resident killer whales are facing than what's happening in these fisheries. The Southeast Alaska fisheries are a really small contributor to the challenges that southern resident killer whales face in their recovery, but anyway, it is what it is.
Kurland explained the nuts and bolts of the lawsuit, which were already known to many in the standing room only crowd in Sitka's Harrigan Centennial Hall, how it stemmed from a 2019 biological opinion prepared by nymphs and the associated incidental take statement required to conduct a fishery that could affect an endangered species. Although the National Marine Fisheries Service has appealed to the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and asked for a decision in June, it's unlikely that the court would act so fast. Instead, Kurland, without giving away too much legal strategy, said nymphs had one trump card it could play.
The agency has the authority under the Endangered Species Act to issue a new biological opinion and a new incidental take statement. It could be reviewed by the court. The court doesn't need to approve it up front, but it's certainly possible that the plaintiffs will take issue with whatever we put out, and we'll ask the court to review it. But there is no implicit requirement or explicit requirement for the court to approve it before it takes effect.
This prompted troller Robert Bateman to drill down.
It's my understanding that once the ITS and the new buy-up has been written, and correct me if I'm wrong, you can basically put that in effect straight away. Now, if that didn't happen before July 1st, could we maybe go fishing in August still?
So your question is, if we are not able to get the new incidental take coverage in place by July 1st, but we get it in later, could there be an opening later in the season? Yes.
Kurland was joined at the meeting by an attorney from the U.S. Department of Justice, which is representing the National Marine Fisheries Service. Kurland explained that the DOJ stepped in any time someone sues the government, and he said, "I get sued all the time." Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
It's been nearly 2 weeks since state fisheries managers announced they'd be closing the Yukon River to salmon fishing in early June. This week, state fisheries biologists and troopers flew to communities on the YK Delta to talk about the closures and enforcement. As KYUK's Francisco Martinez Cuello reports, some of the meetings were contentious.
Hi, everyone. I think we're going to get started because we've got to be over in a moment.
Inside Hooper Bay's Tribal Council building, nearly 50 people gathered to hear from the state on why officials decided to close Chinook salmon fishing in the coastal area from the Naskanat Peninsula up to Point Romanoff. That closure includes Hooper and Scammon Bays, Chivac, Imanik, Kotluk, Nunamiqua, and Alakanuk. The state says the closure is intended to protect Chinook salmon while they migrate upriver to spawns in Alaska and Canada. But most in this crowd are subsistence fishermen, and fishing means survival.
It's like taking away the food off our table.
Alaska Wildlife Trooper Sergeant Walter Blajewski set up the meeting. He says he wanted to give the community an opportunity to ask questions they might have on both fishing opportunities and restrictions. The group included a fish and game biologist, too.
You know, I think the meeting was a success. Our goal was just that, to be available to answer questions and to provide maybe some explanation as to why restrictions were going to be occurring. And I think we accomplished that.
Non-salmon fishing will still be permitted during the closures, but with restrictions. Gill nets limited to 4-inch or smaller mesh and 60 feet or less in length. These nets must be operated as a set net near shore. Blajewski says troopers can't enforce these regulations all the time. They do it when weather and time permits.
We don't often get to the coastal villages, but when we do, we usually go there, for the day. And those type of enforcement patrols are usually conducted, on shore in the village, walking around the village, because we just don't have the resources to get out there.
Dina Jallin works for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. She is currently the Yukon River summer season manager. Jallin says they asked a lot of questions about commercial fishing in the area that sometimes catches the same fish subsistence users are supposed to avoid. In her role as a Yukon River summer season manager, she often fields the same questions from all over the region. What makes Hooper Bay different from others is that it's a coastal community.
In previous years, the coastal area has not been closed. They've had restrictions to 6-inch mesh, but they've typically been left open. They do catch some kings and summer chum as they migrate up along the coast of the Yukon River. So unfortunately, when there's no harvestable surplus, we do feel the need to close that district as well to reduce, to hopefully reduce harvest of king salmon as they travel up along the coast.
Jallin says that those fish in Hooper Bay are either bound for the Yukon, where runs have been very low in recent years, or they're potentially bound for other streams that are either along the coast or other areas of the state. Fisheries managers say they could loosen restrictions if the run is stronger than they're projecting. But right now, Jallin says every district of the Yukon is going to be closed to king salmon. Based on salmon run timing, those closures will work their way up through the entire Yukon area, through all the districts and all the tributaries.
We know it's incredibly frustrating, but we're only taking these actions because the runs are so low that there's no fish available for harvestable surplus.
And that frustration was palpable. Jan Olson is the tribal administrator for the native village of Hooper Bay.
They wanted to ask questions, but a lot of the community members that were attending after the meeting thought that, you know, they really didn't get any answers.
Olson says there's still confusion as to why they are being regulated. They need a fish to survive.
We're not in it for the money. We are in it to put fish in our freezers for future use. And, you know, that's a big part of our diet there. And, you know, that's one thing that we missed.
Olson, along with several other members of the community, say these restrictions will certainly make for a more challenging winter. They don't make enough to buy more groceries. In Hooper Bay, I'm Francisco Martinez Cuello.
More than $2.5 billion in federal funding is heading to coastal communities across the country to prepare for environmental and economic disruptions caused by climate change. U.S. Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo called the funding, quote, the most significant direct investment in climate resilience in the nation's history in a department announcement Tuesday. The money was included in the Federal Inflation Reduction Act, which was passed by Congress last year. It'll be distributed by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The bulk of the money, nearly $600 million worth, will go towards a new grant program for projects aimed at climate resiliency in coastal communities. NOAA says it will announce more details about how that program will work this summer. Almost $400 million will be earmarked specifically for tribes. NOAA consulted with nearly four dozen tribes and native corporations to outline priorities needing a funding boost, like habitat restoration, protecting salmon populations, and better research and monitoring programs. And about $350 million is aimed at what NOAA calls supporting climate-ready fisheries. The money will be distributed nationally. Tuesday's announcement didn't indicate how those funds might shake out regionally or for Alaska, which has more coastline than the entire lower 48. Both Alaska senators voted against the Inflation Reduction Act back in 2022, saying at the time it would add to billions of dollars of spending and new taxes. Alaska's lone U.S. House seat was empty at the time of the vote. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, typical Aleutian weather did not delay on Alaska's second annual Pride event.
This is about making sure that our LGBTQ Two Spirit Plus co-workers, family members, and neighbors know that we love them, that we accept them, that they are safe with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by SNAP.
The Mat-Su School Board passed a pair of board policies aimed at trans students and sex education by a 6-1 vote Wednesday night without much board discussion. Of the 9 board policies that passed, 5 were recommended by the 3-member board policy committee and drew hours of public comment. The most hotly debated policy would require parental permission before a student could change their name or pronouns at school. Melissa Wilkins has 3 children in the district and says she supports the board's policy revisions.
We need to divorce healthcare from education so children have the best chance at economic equity. To do that, they need an education, not an ideology being pushed upon them.
Most people who spoke to the school board were against the parent permission policy, which was introduced 2 weeks ago, but not discussed by the board. The Mat-Su was the first district to ban trans students using bathrooms and playing on sport teams that matched their gender identity last year. Gage Saxton doesn't have students in the district, but at the meeting, he called out board members who supported the policies.
We do not throw away established principles just because a small group of people call for the denial of other people's rights, when your job is to protect the rights and well-being for all those you serve.
The board also passed policies that prohibit activism from teachers in the classroom and prevent school counselors from discussing non-academic matters with students. The only exception made is for child abuse. The next Mat-Su School Board meeting is June 21st, where the board will vote on a policy change that removes language describing libraries as safe, equitable, inclusive spaces. A home heating study in Kotzebue will look at how to reduce diesel fuel consumption in communities off the rail belt. Dominique Pride works at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She's the lead researcher on a National Science Foundation-funded study on heating fuel consumption in the Arctic. Pride says her mission is to find ways to reduce fuel dependence in rural Alaska, especially in colder regions where winter heating bills can be astronomically high.
As anybody that lives in Kotzebue or in Alaska in general that doesn't have access to natural gas, like, it's super expensive to heat our houses here, right? And then there's also the security issue as well. Like, what happens if the barge doesn't come in, right? We're really dependent on heating fuel oil.
Pride and her team are looking for 16 households in Kotzebue to participate in the two-year energy study. Households in the study will receive an energy audit, basically an assessment of how to improve their energy use, effectively reducing their diesel fuel consumption and saving on heating costs. Study participants will be divided into groups. Half the households will receive an energy retrofit. Pride says this could include a variety of energy-efficient improvements catered to the needs of the person's home.
Weather stripping, improving insulation, replacing windows and doors, sometimes replacing the heating appliance in the house.
A second group in the study will receive an electric thermal storage heater, a unit that looks kind of like a large Toyo stove. The technology for these storage heaters isn't new and has been used since the 1940s and more recently in Alaska in the YK Delta community of Kangiganak. Basically, electricity is used to heat an electric resistance coil. Pride compares it to the heating element in a toaster. Once the electric coil gets hot, the heat from the coil is stored for a long period of time in high-density bricks.
The coils and the bricks are enclosed in an insulated cabinet. And as the coil heats up and those bricks heat up, the heat is stored in the cabinet. And then when the homeowner decides that they want to use that heat, they just flip a switch and a fan blows air across the hot bricks and that air is dissipated into the home and heats the home.
Pride says the thermal heaters can hold heat for 24 hours. Some participants in the study will be part of the control group. As a control, they won't receive any energy upgrades or an electric thermal storage heater. However, this group will receive $1,000 for their participation. The two-year study is set to kick off this winter. Pride says she sees potential for the future of renewables in the region where the cost of diesel is so high, but that it starts with getting enough participants. Meanwhile, two Kodiak museums will be collaborating to catalog over 1,000 artifacts never before seen by the public. The Kodiak History Museum and the Aleutic Museum announced the joint project, and as KMXT's Brian Venoir reports, it's the biggest unprocessed collection the History Museum has.
All 1,100 pieces being processed were found around the archipelago in the mid-20th century. Altogether, the stone and bone objects and tools fill about a dozen file boxes. Margaret Greidart is the chief curator for the Kodiak History Museum. She says they're partnering with the Aleutic Museum because they'll need extra hands to process such a huge collection.
We are a small historical society, and this is kind of the first time that we've been able to process a huge collection like this. And so that partnership with the Aleutic Museum is really important in sharing that knowledge. And it also makes sure that both of our collections are comparable to each other.
The artifacts have been waiting a long time to be processed. Greidart says she was excited to receive a grant from Museums Alaska's Collections Management Fund and finally process the finds. The funding allows them to contract with the archaeology staff at the Aleutic Museum to help catalog each item.
A lot of them just look like rocks. They're actually not. Most of them are stone tools. And so that's part of what the Aleutic Museum is going to help us with, is identifying what tools these are, what materials these are, and then rehousing them in a way where you can see everything and you can access everything.
Amanda Lancaster is the curator of collections at the Aleutic Museum. She says the two museums make for an excellent partnership.
I think for a smaller museum, that could be a much bigger project, but because we have the staff capacity and we have that sort of built-in expertise, it can go a little smoother for us, I think, just because we have that. And so, they got the funding and we brought the expertise.
It's a big job. Aleutic Museum staff will wash and dust off each piece and use archival paper and ink to catalog every item or batch of items.
Margaret and I are going to sort of come up with a catalog sheet that gets all the information they need while providing all the context we think is important.
Some of that information includes tool types, field notes, and how deep it was when it was found, and notes about artifact condition. Altogether, about 5 people will be working on the project. They expect to process about 10 objects an hour, depending on how detailed their notes will be. The joint project is slated to have the entire collection processed by the end of the year. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venoir.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
There is a new speed record for climbing Denali. Earlier this week, American climber Jack Kenzel shattered the previous fastest known time by about 90 minutes, making the round trip from base camp at the Kahiltna Glacier to the summit and back in 10 hours, 14 minutes, and 57 seconds. KTNA's Philip Manning spoke with Kenzel after he returned to Talkeetna.
The National Park Service does not keep speed climbing records, so it's up to the community of extreme athletes to keep track of it themselves. That's primarily done through a website called Fastest Known Time. Before his attempt on Denali, Jack Kenzel held 22 speed records on mountains around the world, according to that website. In the past, those records relied largely on the honor system. Today, a combination of GPS data and live tracking allow for easier verification. There are no medals, trophies, or certificates for speed climbing Denali. For Kenzel, the motivation comes down to a sense of accomplishment.
I think like at one end of the spectrum, you have like a pure physical test. You have like a 5K. And then at the other end, you have something like this where it's like, you know, it's a physical test. It's also a test of your ability to acclimatize and to select, you know, a proper window to like prepare the route and have a good boot pack to take the right gear. And then it's also a test of like your ability to ski.
While the climb itself took less than half a day, Kenzel spent 10 days on the mountain preparing, acclimatizing, and waiting for good weather. He says when his window arrived, the weather was perfect.
We got so lucky with the weather that day that I wore the same outfit the entire day from the very start to the summit. I wore a, you know, kind of a long sleeve sun hoodie and then a pair of tights that were like electrically heated and electrically heated socks. But that's all I wore. Like on the summit, all I had was a sun hoodie on.
Speed climbing Denali is an enormous physical and mental challenge. It's also dangerous. Rapid elevation change can lead to a number of medical conditions. Already this season, mountaineering rangers have reported a high number of evacuations due to altitude-related edema from rapid ascents. In addition to the physical challenge, Kenzel describes the mental struggle he dealt with on Denali.
When I'm really pushing it at altitude, I find sometimes I get like a little bit of anxiety and just induced from the altitude, and you know, my brain just kind of, you know, I felt like mush, and like my legs felt like noodles on the summit. So that was like a little bit concerning. So I wanted to make sure I was making good decisions on the way down.
Like many climbers, Kenzel took along an InReach device, which let him keep in touch with the outside world via text. After returning, what had been his potential lifeline on Denali has caused a little anxiety of its own.
I'm like 90% certain I went to the unlimited texting on my like little satellite device, but I really hope so, because it's like 50 cents a message. And I looked this morning and I'd sent 1,400 messages in the 10 days I was on the mountains.
Kenzel says he doesn't plan on taking on another challenge on the scale of Denali, at least not this summer. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Unalaska celebrated its second annual LGBTQ Pride event Friday under gray skies and drizzle. But the weather didn't deter dozens of community members from showing up to the two-hour event to play games, answer trivia questions, and enjoy homemade corn dogs and rainbow cupcakes to the soundtrack of the musical Hair and Diana Ross hits. KUCB's Hope McKinney has the story.
And can you tell me why you're here today?
Celebrated the Rainbow Festival.
Five-year-old Harper and her mom, Emily Gibson, are sitting in front of Unalaska's high school.
Remember we talked about how we are coming here to celebrate love and loving everybody? Mm-hmm. Yep, and does it matter who you love? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's what the rainbow is for. Mm-hmm. And that's a pride festival. That's what we said, huh? Pride. Yeah.
Harper's one of the younger attendees of Unalaska's Pride event, organized by USAFE, or Unalaskans Against Sexual Assault and Family Violence. Emlyn Crane is executive director of the local nonprofit, which runs a food bank and provides an emergency shelter for victims of intimate partner violence, as well as resources on how to recognize and avoid victimization. She says this event is one example of the organization's support for all marginalized communities, who are often at much higher risk of experiencing violence.
I think people are marginalized here in a lot of ways. I think there's a lot of harassment that happens. I think there's a real fear of violence, a valid fear of violence. I think LGBTQ two-spirit people everywhere struggle. So I think we're trying to do better, but I think we could do better than we're doing now.
Speaking in a mic to a group of Unalaskans in the high school parking lot, Crane says she's outraged by efforts across the country to erase LGBTQ two-spirit plus people from public life.
I said it at last year's Pride event, and I'll say it again today. This event is about love. This is about making sure that our LGBTQ two-spirit plus coworkers, family members, and neighbors know that we love them, that we accept them, that they are safe with us, and that we have their backs.
Ivana Rupesho is a trans woman who moved to Unalaska just over 20 years ago. She's dressed in a short black dress, varsity jacket, and bright orange slippers, carrying a banner with a rainbow American flag that reads, "We the people means everyone."
I celebrate myself every day, but it's important for the whole community to celebrate with us.
21-year-old Gilmar Tapawan had a different experience growing up as a gay man in Unalaska.
It was pretty hard. I mean, I had lost many friends when I came out, and I was in junior high. I really kind of was stuck in a corner by myself, just because I was the mainly openly gay man in the school. So I was kind of like the lone wolf, and it was scary.
Tapawan says it was hard finding out his sexuality alone. But he says eventually he found who his true friends were, and he found community support. Back at the mic, Crane from USAFE shares an anecdote with the audience.
I asked a local person who happens to identify as part of our LGBTQ two-spirit community why they thought it was important that USAFE was holding this event, and they said something to the effect of, "So that we know that there are more people that love us than hate us. That's why we're here. It's about love. It's about love. It's about loving our neighbors, loving our children, loving our community, and ultimately loving ourselves. Thank you for coming to Unalaska Pride."
Although the event lasted only 2 hours, participants say they hope the demonstration will show lasting support for the LGBTQ plus community. Reporting in Unalaska, I'm Hope McKenney.
Tuesday, the country's largest LGBTQ plus advocacy organization declared a state of emergency for LGBTQ people in the U.S. The Human Rights Campaign pointed to what it sees as discriminatory legislation targeting the LGBTQ plus community. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Francisco Martinez Cuello in Hooper Bay, Kirsten Dobroth and Brian Benoit in Kodiak, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, and Hope McKenney in Unalaska. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
And by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.